Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast from These Football Times. My name is Gary Thacker, and we're back with another visit to the Mount Rushmore Debating Hall. In this episode, we're focusing on the European Cup before it changed identity into the Champions League, with our advocates attempting to convince me that their choices from this tournament are the most worthy and therefore deserving of a place on the European Cup's own Mount Rushmore monument. The advocates have submitted in order of preference a list of three options for each of their categories of goalkeeper, defender, midfield, forward and coach. I then collated them into a final list to avoid any duplication. I'm delighted to say that of the 15 pitches that we've made this evening, only two are not the advocates' first choices, with both of those actually being second choices, so all pretty good with that. Each advocate will have 3 minutes to make their pitches to the judge, that's me, and I'll decide who has delivered the most convincing, persuading me to declare their selection as the most worthy for a place on Mount Rushmore. At this stage, only I know which players and coaches each advocate has been allocated from their initial selections. All will be revealed in good times. But I'm allowed to say there's been a few inspired inclusions and perhaps some surprising omissions too. For example, in the three options they submitted for goalkeepers, no one selected the only goalkeeper to play in three successive European Cup final victories without conceding a goal, and didn't include any of his defenders who accompanied in those three games as well. Conversely, and here's one to get the advocates thinking, they each selected the same three forwards, albeit, as Eric Morgan would say, about the musical notes of Grieg's Piano Concerto, perhaps not necessarily in the correct order. So let's get down to it and introduce our advocates for this episode. Firstly, the man fast becoming the doyen of left field choices, who then delivers such convincing pitches that we're often left wondering why he was the only guy to come up with a choice. Welcome back to Advocates Row, Dave Bowler. Was casting your mind back more than 30 years to make your selections more difficult than your contemporary options, mate?
I mean, I've done them all so far. I'm sure the listener is really tired of listening to my rubbish. I think of all the ones that we've done, this was the most difficult, actually, to come up with the selection. It was a really tough one.
Yeah, I mean, not only has it gone back a long while, there's a good spread of years as well. We're talking, I mean, best part of 30-odd years. So, yeah, OK. I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say that Dave's choices include another batch of his special sort of selections today as well, so fair warning to the advocates. Secondly, we have the man who was surely dead cert for Advocates Row in this subject, given his brilliant book, The Undisputed Champions of Europe, How the Gods of Football Became European Royalty. Welcome, Stevie Scragg. Stevie, did you consult your book for research and your choices?
Do you know what? I didn't. I didn't. What I did is I went for all of my automatic kind of like first thought of players. That's how I've approached this one. But yeah, I might have to go back and flick through the book and then, you know, think of all the players that I should have picked instead.
Well, I mentioned earlier about the first choice, only two second choices. You're in the fortunate position, Steve. You've got all five of your first choices, mate. So, you know, there's no excuses if you don't win any yours, matey. So, moving on, completing Advocates Row is the man who's playing their first season European Premier Club competition for quite a while. Welcome to TFT's favourite Newcastle United fan and the strongly vociferous supporter of UEFA's VAR, Aidan Williams. Aidan, I'm not sure if you're going to fight through to the next round of the Champions League, but after their win at the weekend, I'm sure you can continue to lift the spirits of the Geordie fans out there with some debate and success. What do you think?
European Cup era, I obviously can't go to any Newcastle players. I suspect Stevens didn't need his research because he just picked five Liverpool players. Such was their glory in those days. But we will see. We will see. But no, I think I've got some good ones in there in amongst my choices.
You surely have, mate. And you'll be relieved to say that UEFA's VAR has been suspended from this debating situation. Okay, so let's kick the ball. Let's get the ball out and have a kick around. We're going to start with goalkeepers. And work in alphabetical order. Dave, you're first, mate. So I'm just going to get the stopwatch ready. You're going to have 3 minutes for your pitch. So away you go now.
Using the system that I've always had of trying to go for iconics that's been so wildly unsuccessful in all the previous episodes, I've gone for Helmut Duckerdam, who I think has to be the only choice, and given that he did, as a goalkeeper, win the European Cup for Steaua Bucharest in their famous victory over Barcelona by getting them to the penalty shootout, getting them through extra time, keeping a clean sheet, and then saving four penalties, which for any goalkeeper, I think, is has to be seen as iconic, and therefore getting him on Mount Rushmore. He had a particularly good season through that European Cup run, particularly when he got to the difficult end of the competition. He was unbeatable in the latter rounds. Kept four clean sheets in the five games from the quarterfinals through to the finish. But it's obviously the penalty shootout in that final that he's become sort of legendary for. It was Steaua who actually started, and they missed their first penalty in the bottom right hand side. Then Alisenko steps up to take Barcelona's first one. And Duckerdam said later, this was the most difficult one to save because I had nothing to go on. I hadn't seen him take any penalties. So I just guessed. And this one, I guessed right and made the save. The second one, Steaua take the second penalty. That saved as well. Barcelona come to take theirs. And so now Duckerdam is saying, right, I took a logical approach from here. Verratti had gone right and then left. So I thought I'd have to change that system. I'd go right again. I went to the right and made a save. And this is a particularly, if you look at the footage on YouTube, it's a great save. Down low to his right. It's a really, really good stop. So I'd actually score a penalty, the third one they score. So Pichi Alonso steps up to take the third one for Barcelona. And he reckons that this one, the taker's got to reckon that I'm going to get to the left this time. Because I've gone right twice. He must think I'm going to the left. So what I'll do is I'll go right. The penalty's in exactly the same spot again. And he saves it again. Steaua take another one. Score. So Marcos now has to score. And he's working out, right, what do I do now? I've gone right three times. I can't go right again. So he starts dancing about on the line a little bit, moves right, moves left, confuses the taker. It's an absolutely atrocious penalty from Marcos. He goes to his left, saves it, and that's it. The European Cup's won. What more can you say? So four penalties in the shootout.
Time, Dave. That's got to Sorry, mate. That's time, buddy.
I'm done.
You're done. It's a typical Dave Bowler selection. Interesting. A guy who's, when I looked at your selection, I thought, who is this guy? I looked up and thought, okay, yeah, that's a Dave Bowler special, that is. Stevie, we're going to go to you next. Your choice is a bit more famous. Away you go, buddy.
Well, you might be surprised to hear that I've gone for Ray Clements, and I'm going to keep bringing Ray Clements back to this table over and over again until he's got his rightful spot up on the Mount Rushmore on the Bates Mountain. So I'm fully expecting episodes on Scunthorpe United to come and the footballing gods of Skegness if he doesn't win this one. But it is Ray Clements, the all and only Ray Clements, winner in 1977, 1978 and 1981. Just for that save alone in 77, while the game is right on a knife edge, it's everything that underpins Liverpool's success at that point in time. Now, his magnificence against Saint-Étienne in the quarter-final. Everything is built on the back of the brilliance of Ray Clements. Now, if there's any other goalkeeper in goal for Liverpool, they don't do what they go on to do there. Borussia Mönchengladbach in the final. Excellent. Borussia Mönchengladbach in the following year's semi-final in 78. Just magnificent. Yeah, clean sheets at Wembley in 78, another clean sheet in Paris in 81 in the final against Real Madrid. Games against CSKA Sofia in 81, Alex Ferguson, Zabadeen in 81 as well, 80-81. Bayern Munich in that semi-final, the Howard Gale semi-final of 81. So many indelible moments. And it's all down to the fact that it's all taken for granted it was taken for granted at the time because he was so magnificent. And in the period of time that passed now, we tend to laud the ones that are overseas, but we neglect in a way the brilliance that we had on our own doorstep. And that's Ray Clements for me. The only goal he conceded in the European Cup final came for the brilliant feat of Alan Seamonson. He was, you know, was he twice European Footballer of the Year? One of the most wonderful footballers. The only man that could beat him in the European Cup final. He got to the 81 final, sat in the dressing room after the match, and that's where he decided, I've conquered every mountain with Liverpool. I'm going to have to find a new challenge. But on the flip side of that, Liverpool went out the following year, 81-82, to CSKA in a repeat quarter-final. And I think especially 82-83, the Widzew Lods defeat. If Ray Clements is still the Liverpool goalkeeper for both of those games, I think Liverpool go on to win at least one of those two European Cups, be it 82 or 83. That's how important Ray Clements was to the Liverpool cause, and that magnificent 3-5. There's only one answer to this, and it's Ray Clements.
Great stuff, mate. Great timing as well. Yeah, I mean, yeah, two different, totally different goalkeepers there. So we had Dukadamu, who was sort of his fame was fleeting but magnificent, and Clements obviously much more longer lasting. So Aidan, coming to you next, very different goalkeepers, and I think yours is erring much towards Clements than Dukadam. So tell me about your guy starting there, mate.
Well, obviously better than either of those. So if you follow the line of succession of great Bayern Munich and German goalkeepers back from Manuel Neuer, you pass Oliver Kahn, you make a quick Belgian detour to Jean-Marie Pfaff, and you reach Sepp Maier, the first great Bayern goalkeeper. The Cat from Anzing, as he was known. Now, any goalkeeper who's known as the Cat has to be special. More than that, he was also an innovator ahead of his time with his forays out of his goal mouth, a sweeper keeper way before we ever even thought of such a term. And of course, he was a key part of the legendary Bayern team of the 1970s, which won 3 European Cups in a row. Not just that, they also won 4 Bundesliga titles and 3 German Cups as well. Not bad at all for someone who was a striker at youth level, who only used to play in goal occasionally as a joke. I think we can all appreciate that kind of commitment to the role. But it's the 3 European Cups in a row which interest us here, beating Atletico Madrid in 1974, Leeds United in 1975, and Saint Etienne in 1976. Having already won the Cup Winners' Cup with Bayern in 67 as well, that's another one to throw in the mix. But in those 3 European Cup finals, that's a total of 4 matches in the end, because they had to have a replay against Atletico in 1974 in those days. He conceded just 1 goal. That's 1 goal in 390 minutes. So that blows away Stevens Clements' argument, and it blows away the mystery keeper you were talking about, Gary, as well, with his 3 matches. So this is much, much more time that this guy only conceded the 1 in. That 1 goal came late in extra time of that first final, caught out by a fabulous free kick from Luis Aragonés. But Bayern equalised in the dying seconds to take it to a replay. And from that point on, Maier would not be beaten again in the 3 European Cup finals. It was also that particular final was a hugely significant moment for both clubs. It set them on massively different paths for decades. He was also a World Cup winner a few weeks later. Sorry, Gary. But Bayern became the dominant European force, taken over from Ajax again. Sorry, Gary. In 1975, finally, he was a hero across 2 legs with the Soviet champions Ararat Yerevan in the quarterfinals before keeping 2 clean sheets against Saint Etienne in the semis and again against Leeds in the final. And they met Saint Etienne again in the 76 final, a win built on defensive solidity, at the heart of which, of course, was Maier with his consistent and often breathtaking displays in goal. He's an all-time great for Bayern and Germany, a keeper way ahead of his time, and a European Cup legend in 3 successive years as the rock of a fabulously stingy and stylish defence.
I'm going to have some thinking time on this, so I'm going to just chuck this out to you guys for a bit then. Starting with you, Stevie. If we ignore Ray Clements, we've got 2 totally different goalkeepers, well, 2 totally different goalkeepers' claims to be included in Mount Rushmore, with Dukadam, with Dave, and Sepp Maier with Aidan. What are your thoughts, mate?
Sepp Maier, if it wasn't for a crooked referee in 75, he's conceding at least 3. 76, if it wasn't for the square goalposts of Hampden Park, he's conceding another 3. No, there's a lot of shade here at play. You know, Aidan's gone for the Bond villain. where I've gone for the purity of Ray Clements. It has to be Helmut Duckerdam if I can't vote for Ray Clements.
Great. Well put, Stevie. Well put. I'm not sure you can see those six girls would be right, but there, we'll give you that. Aiden, ignore Settmeyer, who actually conceded a goal in three games, whereas the guy who was mentioned, Heinz Dye, played three
games. In four games.
Never
four
a
games.
Goal at all, rather than conceding one, he only went to a replay. But if we ignore Settmeyer.
Well, yes, but that's only 270 minutes, Gary. That's only 270 minutes. My guy did it over much more than that.
But he's called out by Luis Aragonés. There you go. Luis Aragonés.
Oh dear me.
Anyway, moving swiftly.
Anyway,
if we just step to one side for a moment, looking away into his huge gloves for a moment, and Duckerdam or Clements, what are your thoughts on the choice between those two, Aiden?
Well, I do love the sort of left field Duckerdam pick, but essentially that's just a penalty shootout against some terrible penalty takers. Ray Clements was actually on my list, although I feel like, given Stephen slating a Settmeyer, that I feel like I shouldn't say that. The other one on my list was Nigel Spink, actually, I guess for similar reasons to the Duckerdam, you know, a bit of a hero coming from nowhere. But yeah, Clements was on my list. So if it's not going to be Meyer, I think I would go for him.
Good man. Good man.
Dave, if we put your left field back into out of play for a second, two very similar sort of choices between Clements and Meyer. Can you separate them for me?
I think I had Settmeyer as my second choice, possibly, or my third choice, with Nigel Spink as the other one. So I suppose I've got
no Clements at all.
I've got to stick with...
Dave knew who I was going to pick.
Exactly, there's no
doubt. Yeah. There was no doubt.
So there was, I was thinking of throwing Peter Shilton in just to upset everybody, but I didn't bother in the end. I think in the end, I'll have to stick with my choice of Settmeyer, but I think Stephen's case was pretty persuasive.
I honestly thought about the Peter Shilton thing. I thought there's no way I could possibly have that if Stephen's going to be on this, so I just didn't.
Excellent.
Okay. I think with both Clements and Meyer, they were playing behind a decent defence, or more than decent defence, exceptional defence, whereas it wasn't true with Duckerdam. And it was nil-nil, I think it was 0-0 before extra time in the final against Barcelona, against Venables' Barcelona. Rest in peace to Eltel. So that's quite a convincing pitch in typical Dave Bowler fashion. But I think I've got to go for Ray Clements because...
Just to save the series for me picking Ray Clements every time. I understand the vote, but I'm taking it. I'm taking it, and the rest of the podcast, I'm happy to freewheel from here. My work here is done.
That Skegness episode will never happen.
Oh, I just can't.
Steve disappears to go and renew his membership of the Ray Clements fan club. He celebrates that. Close call for Settmeyer as well, and Duckerdam is a totally different... approach, but no less worthy for that. But I'm going to go with Ray Clements. I think that's the right call for the goalkeeper. So we're going to move out of the penalty area for a little bit and talk about defenders. So, Stevie, you're going to kick me off with a Liverpool player, matey. Away you go.
I am, surprisingly, and I promise there are some non-Liverpool players as part of this as well. But, you know, when I come to think about it, it's you know, Phil Neal just takes some beat in the four finals. As a winner, a right back who scores in two finals, one of them, a penalty in 77, but in free play on the edge of the 6-yard box in the first half of a European Cup final in Rome against Roma. You know, that's an absolutely wild thing to be happening. You know, and here's a player, he would go on to be captain in the ill-fated 85 final and the. You know, everything that was on his shoulders that night as well plays a part in this for me. But 77, you know, he was up against Herbert Wimmer and Christian Kulik. In 77, Daniel Tukuba and Jan Sorensen, the excellent Jan Sorensen. 81, he was up against Laurie Cunningham, Uli Stielike, and Jose Antonio Camacho. Three of them bearing down on him. And in 84, it was Falcao, Francesco Graziani and Bruno Conti that he had to deal with. You know, if the 85 final had have played out the way, you know, it had been the match it should have been, he'd have been contending with the likes of Zygmunt Boniek and Paolo Rossi. You know, and obviously did the game took place, but it was shadow boxing on a horrific night. For Phil Neal, it's that consistency. It's kind of the fact that he's the prototype Maldini in so many ways in this respect. You know, his contribution to Liverpool's successes over those years is phenomenal, and he's the only player of that Liverpool era to have played in all four of those finals between 77 and 84. You know, his consistency and his importance. I mean, people look on, you know, rampaging fullbacks as a new thing, and it's not. You know, it's just reinventing the wheel. You know, as much as I love Trent Alexander, and that puts a different, you know, a whole new kind of like version of a fullback. But you know, we used to, you know, call Phil Neal Zico. That was the name he had. You know, and he was just majestic and massively important to Liverpool during this period. Especially a lot of those away games, especially into Eastern Europe, you know, Dinamo Bucharest in the semi-final in 84 was a standout one as well. You know, he was just one of these that would always rise to the massive away occasion. Atletico in 83, 84 as well is another one that always springs to mind. Consistency and success and dependability. You know, and his goal score, the fact that he's a right back who scores in two European Cup finals, four times winner, Phil Neal.
Nice one, Stevie. Nice one. Yet again, another. I mean, I suppose, you know, it's some might say Stevie's picking Liverpool players, but, you know, Liverpool's got a rich history of European Cup success there, and Phil Neal certainly is worthy of a pitch. Aidan, going to move to you next. Go, away you go. Make your pitch, buddy.
Well, I'm staying in southern Germany again. I'm with Bayern Munich once more. I did contemplate a little detour down to Italy, but no, I'm with Germany again. Der Kaiser, the Emperor, a nickname fit for the European Cup. Absolutely, if there was one. He's simply one of the most elegant, stylish, sophisticated players of the last century. His achievements, of course, go far beyond Bayern into international greatness, of course, but with Bayern, he not only played and won three European Cups in a row, just like Sepp Maier, the sadly jilted goalkeeper, but he captained the team from the back in his typically confident and assured manner. Everything he did was done with a stylish simplicity, or at least the perception, the look of a stylish simplicity, you know, the complex made to appear simple. Beyond that, he more or less invented the role of the modern sweeper too, the libero, with the assuredness given by Maier behind him. Now, I've already mentioned the three cup finals specifically, but suffice to say that Beckenbauer was the rock around which the greatness of Bayern Munich in the 70s was built. He was, you know, Stephen's listing of some of the players Phil Neal was up against there. Well, in Beckenbauer's case, There was a bit of a mixture, I guess, but if I focus on 75 and Leeds, the nice contrast between the robust characteristics of Joe Jordan and Alan Clark up against him, with Billy Bremner and a few other robust types snapping away at his heels, and then you've got the calm assuredness of Beckenbauer just outshining them all. And he was also the leader, like I say. Leadership is a difficult quality, and especially a good leader is a rarity. But by Beckenbauer, it was never a problem. This was just all well within his gift. For this Bayern team to have taken on the mantle of Ajax and taken over their position of dominance, it was a great achievement. But for Beckenbauer, it was just simply another step in his ascent to the grandest levels of sporting excellence. He embellished it at international level, of course, and perhaps is better known for his international glory. But Beckenbauer led and inspired this great Bayern team to achieve the greatness they did. As much as Maier, Müller, Hoeneß, Schwarzenbeck, Breitner et al. May have grabbed some of the headlines, it was Beckenbauer who provided the impetus and leadership as well as the style and grace for it all to be possible.
Nice one. Comfortably inside the time as well, 2 minutes 30 seconds. So that should be a awarded bonus point for that, I guess. Dave, now we've got two guys there who have established pedigree, you know, and would be in the pantheon of European Cup heroes. Where are you going with your guy, mate?
I always like the unlikely winners or the surprises, and I've picked Billy McNeil as my defender, as being emblematic of Celtic 1967. the Lisbon Lions that beat Internazionale to win the European Cup in 67, much against the odds, much to everybody's surprise. I mean, McNeil was a great leader of that team. He was a fellow who was nicknamed Caesar, and that nickname had two distinct periods in his life. I mean, he was originally nicknamed Caesar after Cesar Romero, the American actor who we all probably best remember as the Joker in the Batman TV series in the 60s. But as time went on, I mean, Caesar became the perfect name for a fella who was the great leader, the great captain of that Celtic team. And, you know, that Celtic team, the Lisbon Lions, as everybody knows, it was an incredibly local side. It was, I think they were all born within 10 miles of Celtic Park, except for Tommy Gemmell, who was 11 miles away, damn it, and Bobby Lennox, who was as far away as 30 miles. I probably needed a passport to get into Celtic Park every time he turned up. It was a remarkable success that year under Jock Stein. They won the quadruple. They won all four tournaments that they went in for, League Cup, the Scottish Cup and the European Cup. A magnificent side, and Billy McNeil was at the heart of it. But that Celtic team didn't just win the 1967 European Cup. They had a great run over the next sort of 6 or 7 years. They got to the quarterfinal in 69. They reached the final in 1970, quarterfinals against 71. They lost the semi-final on penalties to Inter in 72, another semi-final in 74. And I don't think it's any coincidence that run came to an end with Billy McNeil's retirement. I mean, his retirement saw the end of Celtic as a great European power. I mean, a great man at the club, a one-club man in that sense. And I think he's one of those people that you get at a football club that just, he is the emblem of that football club. He sums up everything that's good about the place. And I think that 1967 win was one of the great early wins, one of the great surprise wins in a European Cup that had been dominated by perhaps the obvious powers at that point. Celtic's win was a complete change. Obviously, the first time a British team had won the European Cup as well. So I think for all of that, Billy McNeil has got to be seen as an icon of not just of Celtic, but of British football and of the European Cup.
Okay. You see, I guess I don't know if many listeners would be in a similar sort of situation as me. Obviously we know about McNeil captaining Celtic for success in 67, but as you go on through the years, the next four or five years, that success wasn't isolated. Well, the triumph was, but obviously there were still contenders as go on, and as you say, led by McNeil. So, yeah, Stevie, if you put Phil Neal to one side, you've got Beckenbauer and Billy McNeil, two totally different type of defenders. What are your thoughts, mate?
And they're both two fantastic choices. When Dave initially said Billy McNeil, I got it, but I think, his eulogy of him, just brought it that much closer. As much as I saw Billy McNeil and thought, that's a great choice, but Beckenbauer. And Dave's kind of like brought that right in and narrowed that gap. It needs to be Beckenbauer, though, because as Aidan said, he's simply De Keyser. He is the general's general as far as the position's concerned, and that way you would sweep up the pitch and join the attacks, and that libero effect and everything that revolved around him and that special aura. McNeil, magnificent. But I associate him so much with the Lisbon Lions and the collective rather than the individual. And I can't really say that Bayern Munich, Beckenbauer and Gerd Müller, they're the big standout figures of that side, and Meyer as well. All joking aside earlier on, Meyer, what a spectacular role that he played in that success. That is the spine of one of the greats. People are begrudging about it, but I don't think anyone, as much as you can begrudge a Bayern Munich of being this megalith and, all of that kind of strangulation of football almost compared to what Ajax did, Beckenbauer would have slotted into Ajax and not looked out of place in the slightest. Beckenbauer is just one that transcends eras, styles of play. And that's why, for me, it would have to be Beckenbauer.
Fair comment. Not sure Beckenbauer get in ahead of Barry Hall's shot, but that's put that to one side for a second. Aidan. So if we put your guy to one side for a moment, Beckenbauer. So we've got Phil Neal and we've got Billy McNeil. What are your feelings?
Strong evidence for both. I don't know what it is about Phil Neal, and maybe it's his time with Graham Taylor. He just leaves me cold. I don't know what it is. You know, I can appreciate he was a great player and leader as well for Liverpool. He dispatches penalties with side-footed simplicity again and again. But I don't know, he just leaves me a bit cold. Equally with a Liverpool fullback, Alan Kennedy's another one who scored in two European Cup finals, shouting up for the Northeast lads there from down the road in concert. But yes, he scored two winning goals, one of them being a shootout penalty, I guess, but that's well worth another shout. So I think I'm talking myself into going for Billy McNeil here. I must confess, like Stephen said, the collective is what leaps to mind about that Celtic team, but there are strong characters and leaders within it. I guess we're all sort of picking leadership types here as well, which says something about the defensive roles in teams. But yeah, this time I'll go for Billy McNeil.
Okay, yeah, reasonable choice. Dave, so if you put your guy to one, so I got two very similar situations with these guys, Phil Neal and Beckenbauer. What are your thoughts, mate?
Two fantastic choices and extremely well argued. I mean, funny enough, I mean, I think I had Beckenbauer as one of the choices. I think Alan Kennedy was my third one. I did toy with Tommy Smith as well as the Brick Gazelle with a header, just as an iconic moment. But I mean, it's a great case for Phil Neal. But he's Franz Beckenbauer, isn't he? So, you know, in the end, it's Franz Beckenbauer. It's like arguing against Pelé or something, isn't it?
yeah, I think it is, yeah. It's interesting that obviously first choice was Beckenbauer, and both Steve and Dave had Beckenbauer as their second choices. So you can see there's strong support for Beckenbauer. And, you know, Billy McNeil, I think, has a case in as much as the other players in his defence and the goalkeeper were far less celebrated than the guys that Beckenbauer and Phil Neal were playing with. I mean, the back four Celtic, remember correctly, it was completed by Craig Clark and Tommy Gemmell. You can probably reel off the players that Beckenbauer and Phil Neal played with. I'm going to go with Beckenbauer. I think anything else would be just obtuse. It'd be difficult to argue, you know, with any reason against Beckenbauer. So we're going to go with Beckenbauer. So, Aidan, flush with your success there. You kick us off in midfield. Away you go, buddy.
Some might claim, I guess, that Ferenc Puskás was a forward, but none of that. He was generally deployed as an inside left for both Hungary in their pomp and Real Madrid in theirs. But for Hungary, his role was slightly more advanced, given their propensity for the deep-lying forward, the false nine, if you like. But for Real Madrid, he was definitely there to complement the forward excellence of Alfredo Di Stefano, allowing Puskás to roam a little freer and a little deeper. So midfield, he is. Attacking midfield. So I'm feeling fully justified in claiming that on this occasion. His story, though, leaving Hungary as the revolution took hold, or being out of the country as the revolution took hold, and finding a new lease of life, a second career, in fact, in Madrid. It's quite a fabulous story in and of itself. He would win the top scorer, the Pichichi, more than once, twice, I think, in Spain, the top goal scorer. But more than that, he would form one of the greatest attacking units and teams in European history. He won the European Cup three times, 1959, 1960, and 1966, scoring 35 goals in 39 European Cup games for Real. He sadly only got to play in one of those winning finals due to injury, but was a key part of the team throughout the competitions regardless. In 1959, he scored twice in the critical semi-final against Atletico, a tie which went to a replay, the eventual winning goal coming from Puskás. Injury robbed him of a place in the final, though, a 2-0 win over Reims. The following year, he scored three in the two semi-final games against Barcelona as Real destroyed their rivals on the way to the final again. He took that even further in the final itself, though, by scoring four in that remarkable 1960 final against Eintracht Frankfurt at Hampden, one of the most famous European Cup finals there has ever been. That was, of course, the pinnacle of both this Real and of Puskás's Real career. He was, of course, the first to score four in a European Cup final. He scored several more hat-tricks in subsequent European campaigns, including in the 1962 final defeat to Benfica. Again, he was the first to score hat-tricks in two finals. And in fact, one of those was four goals, so even better. In 65-66, he scored again at will, notably with five against Feyenoord, but again missed out on the final, this time a win over Partizan Belgrade. But this phase of his career was every bit as extraordinary as his first with Honved and Hungary. An astonishing player, almost reinvented, certainly rejuvenated to become a hero all over again, taking his greatness into whole new realms. A second career, almost completely split from his first, double-sized as well. But he was spectacular in everything he did in the greatest European Cup team of all.
Okay, Dave, I'm going to come to you next. And a similar era, perhaps a little bit later. Tell me your choice, mate.
If football is just judged on football, all it is 22 blokes chasing a bag of wind. Football is what we love because it's full of stories. It's full of the human spirit. It's romance. It's glory. It's all those things. And the ultimate European Cup story is Bobby Charlton. I feel like I'm doing Bobby Charlton the same way that Stephen does Ray Clements. But anyway, there is no story like Bobby Charlton in the European Cup. 1958, he's just scored in Belgrade. He's taken Manchester United through to the semi-finals of the European Cup. And then on the way home, the Munich disaster happens. He loses a large swathe of his mates. Some die, some never play again. And then from there on, although others survive, Harry Gregg, Bill Foulkes and whatever, Bobby Charlton is the flag bearer of Manchester United. From that point on, he is the focus of the rebirth. Because, you know, he's a great player. He goes on to play for England, all of that sort of stuff. And from there is, I mean, I know this sounds like a Hollywood film, which I suppose it is really in a way, but there's this need to make that sacrifice count for something. Manchester United have got to deliver the European Cup. And it's an era when it's much more difficult to win the European Cup. Not in the sense that, you know, the Champions League now isn't filled with more and more great teams, which of course it is. But back then you had to win the league to get into the European Cup. And that wasn't such an easy thing to do. So, you know, Manchester United rebuilt. They put a team together in 65-66, which got to the semi-finals, beaten by Partizan Belgrade. And then they couldn't compete again until 67-68, at which point, you know, they just missed out on retaining the title. Bobby Charlton's 31. Will there be another chance? They play at Wembley in that cup final against Benfica. And Bobby Charlton is, you know, the emblem of Manchester United that night. He scores the first goal that almost wins the game anyway. And then when they go into extra time, he scores that ridiculous looping shot that seals the game at 4-1. Then he goes up the steps at Wembley, lifts the European Cup, and all of a sudden, you know, that story that begins in tragedy gets the happy ending, I suppose, of sorts. It's, you know, the sacrifice is made worthwhile, and Bobby Charlton has done the right thing by Duncan Edwards and Roger Byrne and all those other guys that ended up in the snows in Munich. So if you want glory, you want romance, it's Bobby Charlton. That has to be on Mount Rushmore. I'm sorry, that's it.
I mean, it's great. It's a great romantic story. Yeah. Stevie, got two strong pitches there. And you're going to go back to the era of Puskás, aren't you, for your guy, mate? So away you go.
Yeah, I can reassure everyone I'm not going for Sammy Lee on this one. I'm going Iberian, and it's Paco Gento, just metronomic. Falls under the radar, you know, for a lot of people, but this is the player who played in, you know, Real Madrid's first eight European Cup finals, you know, a winner six times. He's the only player in that span, 56 to 66, that is part of six winning sides. He's part of that side with Di Stefano and Puskás and all of those greats. But then he transcends the era and sweeps into the next one. You know, Real Madrid's, you know, lesser fabled Yeye side of the mid 1960s. You know, a nod towards the Beatles and the in the nickname the side was given. The name was the side was given, and Gento captains 66 as well. Now he is the captain when they lose in 62 and in 64 against Benfica and Inter respectively. So by the time he lifts the European Cup in 66, he's, you know, it's his third go at trying to win it as captain, having won it five times as being one of the support cast. But as left wingers go, he was an incredible player. You know, the close control, the cannonball of a left foot, the innate skill that he had, the speed, incredible burst of acceleration that he had, and he would hunch and head down and he wouldn't look at his opponents and his left opponents to look at the ball and the fleetness of his feet, and he was gone. You know, you'd go look up the footage. I mean, I totally get that either of the two that have been mentioned already stand, you know, in legendary terms, you know, above Paco Gento in the great scheme of things. But Gento's contribution to what Real Madrid did, you know, needs mentioning. You know, it was just absolutely ludicrous what he could do with a football. You know, all the tricks and flicks that you would associate with a more contemporary player, they're there to see. You know, the dummies, the drop of the shoulder, the nutmegs, the tricks, the flicks, everything. The ball just attached to his feet. A lot of Garrincha about his style in many ways, except with straight knees. You know, this is, you know, the most metronomic of European Cup legends. You know, eight finals, six times a winner, at the third time of asking as a captain. You know, transcended two major Real Madrid eras. You know, there at the start of that run, there at the end of that run, went on to be president of the club, honorary president of the club. An incredible individual.
I've got some great pictures here. Aiden, I need a bit of help here, matey. You've got the romance story of Bobby Charlton and the phenomenal success and longevity of Paco Gento. What do you think, buddy?
Yeah, it's a very, very tough one, this is. I think that Real Madrid team was obviously, as I was alluding to, spectacular in every sense, especially going forwards. And Paco Gento is clearly a key part of that. Though, is he as key as Puskas, Di Stefano and so on? Arguable. But his longevity is astonishing. Bobby Charlton's longevity is vastly impressive as well, though not all in the European Cup, but the sort of two key moments of his club career are European Cup. I think the sort of romance of that story edges it for me, but not by a lot, not by a lot. But yeah, I think I would pick Bobby Charlton.
Dave, put the late lamented to Bobby Charlton to one side. You've got two legends of Los Blancos to compare here. Puskas and Argento. What do you think, mate?
It's interesting to have two from the same side compared. I mean, you know, Puskas is obviously the one that stands out in the same way that Di Stefano does. You know, they're the ones that are the ones that you think of. They're your immediate go-tos, aren't they? When you think of that Real Madrid side more than Gento. I mean, it's a really interesting pitch from Stephen. But, you know, you go back to those ridiculous goal-scoring figures from Aiden about Puskas. I mean, if you're scoring goals at that rate, I think you've got every possible claim to be on Mount Rushmore, particularly if you're scoring them from midfield. So I think in the end, you just have to have Puskas, but not by a lot.
OK, Stevie, on one hand, you've got a Real Madrid player. On the other hand, you've got a Manchester United player. I know your adherence to Manchester United as a strong advocate for their team, but what are you thinking, buddy?
Two incredible, legends brought to the table here. Two, you know, they should have won more European Cups between the two of them. It seems mad that they both walked away with one European Cup winners' medal each. You know, Aiden's picked a player that's just, you know, steeped in iconography in Puskas, and that iconic 1960 final at Hampden Park. You know, it's the benchmark, I think, by which all European Cup finals, Champions League finals, you know, has to be measured. And then you've got, you know, the incredible story of Bobby Charlton, who, you know, as Dave, you know, mentioned, went from the wreckage of Munich all the way to Wembley, you know, carrying not just, you know, his own prophecy, but the prophecy of friends that he lost a decade earlier. And for me, that's what just edges it for, and it really is just edges it. You know, Pushkas had so much respect for him. Always loved the story of Pushkas that David Beckham used to say about his time at Real Madrid, and the youth kids laughing at this short, portly fella, this old fella on the training ground who'd go and do his daily workouts and stuff like that, and then you know, Beckham lined these balls, and Pushkas just kept on rattling them from 30 yards with precise accuracy off the crossbar, to the bewilderment of these teenagers that just had no idea who he was, you know, whose presence they were within. So, you know, Pushkas, yeah, you know, totally breathing right down the neck of Bobby Charlton there. But I've got to go Bobby Charlton.
I mean, listening to the pitches, I think, you know, there's a flag paper between the two Real Madrid players. The fact that Paco Gento played in 8 European Cup finals, won 6 of them, I think it's got to give him just a slight edge over Pushkas. But I think the fairy tale of Bobby Charlton is going to just persuade me to go with Bobby Charlton on this one. Because I think as Dave mentioned, you know, coming from the wreckage of of Munich and completing the victory, for not only for the guys who were there, but for the guys who weren't there. Yeah, I'm going to go with Bobby Charlton. It's close. I mean, it's a bit harsh on Paco Gento, but I'm going to go with Bobby Charlton. Dave, take me to a forward, buddy. Tell me who you're going to pick to follow up on your success with Bobby Charlton. Away you go.
Terribly sorry, Gary, that none of us as yet have picked anybody from Ajax. And we do keep picking Bayern Munich because it's Gerd Müller who is my choice as the striker. Just, I mean, the most ridiculous goal-scoring record over a long period of time in the European Cup. I mean, in 73, top scorer, 11 goals, and they were knocked out in the quarterfinals. 74, top scorer with 8. 75, joint top scorer with 5. 76, joint second with 5. 1977, top scorer with 5. Every year, metronomic in the European Cup, just scoring goals like it was going out of fashion. And, you know, he's got that. I was watching the Atletico Madrid final highlights on that this afternoon. And he's got that same thing as Jimmy Greaves. Before Bayern Munich play, the last thing that the manager from the opposition would say is, and this fella Müller, you do not let him have the ball. You crowd him out. You don't give him any space. You don't give him anything. And then all of a sudden, the ball comes in from the left. He's standing on his own at the back post in yards of space, has time for a touch, and then belts the ball into the back of the net. And that's in the same way as Jimmy Greaves, I suppose. That's what makes him something exceptional. I mean, he scores in every game he ever plays in. And yet, he's always finding the ball in acres of space with all the time in the world to do what it is that he does. And, you know, you look at him and it's like Bill Oddie running around the European Cup final. He doesn't look like a lethal goal-scoring machine. You know, I mean, he's this little squat fella. But, I mean, he's got this incredible burst of acceleration over 3 or 4 yards, low centre of gravity. He's always in the right place at the right time. 3 consecutive final wins. And I mean, you know, you don't necessarily want to bring all this down just to statistics, but I mean, 34 goals in 35 European Cup games overall, which puts him 23rd on the list. There's only Di Stefano, Eusebio and Pushkas above him from the European Cup era before we get into the Champions League, and they're playing every other week. 365 goals in 427 games in the Bundesliga, 65 in 74 European games for Bayern, 68 in 62 for West Germany. I mean, he was the absolute out-and-out finisher through of that era in through the 70s. There was no goal scorer like him, and I don't always go for choices like that, but I think you can't look beyond Gerd Müller for that particular period as the goal scorer supreme.
Yeah, it's a good call. It's a good pitch. It's a good pitch. Remember Stevie, a different type of forward, and Dave mentioned absence of representatives from a certain team. You're going to put that right for me, Stevie, now. Where you go?
Indeed I am. Just like Beckenbauer. just like Cruyff, just like Charlton, it obviously has to be Cruyff. He was the European Cup. He is, you know, the European Cup's greatest idol, really. You know, the brains behind the brains. So you've got Meikles, you've got Cruyff, and then you've got Kovacs as well, who takes the handbrake off. And Cruyff is the, you know, the man with, I don't know, he's got the compass on the pitch, basically. You know, he dictates absolutely everything, the tempo, the style, you know, the swagger. You know, he's everywhere he needs to be. And he's everywhere where the opposition needs him not to be. You know, is just absolutely everything about him just drips style. But it all comes in wrapped in such substance. You know, from a kid taking Liverpool apart, not just in Amsterdam, but he came to Anfield and scored twice as well. You know, a bewildering night of football that I know people who were there that night and have said, never a better performance by a player in an opposition shirt on an Anfield European night. You know, runner-up in 69, you know, winner 71, 72 and 73. That indelible final against Inter in Rotterdam. Those goals, that twist, that turn, that jump, that punch of the air in that strip. You know, it is all European Cup, just as a colour television era kicks into life as well. He couldn't have timed it any better. You know, we're not talking about someone kicking a ball in grainy, you know, monochrome black and white as if on the surface of the moon here. This is reach out and touch kind of territory now. And Gerd Müller plays, you know, has that as well. But this is just utter vivid technicolour. You know, the quarterfinal comeback in 69 against Benfica. You know, CSKA in 72-73, the Bayern quarterfinal, the 4-0 demolition. It's more than just the finals themselves. You know, a lot of selflessness in the 71 and 73 finals that he has to put in to make others the hero. But it's 72 that is just utterly hypnotic. You watch him in the 1972 final, and that's the man at his peak. And it's wild that he only plays one more season of European Cup football beyond the 1973 final, and that's in a Barcelona shirt in 74-75, when, sorry, Leeds United, but, you know, we were denied, you know, the concept of Cruyff in a Barcelona shirt up against that incredible Bayern Munich side of Meyer, Beckenbauer and Müller. What could have been that 1975 final? There's only one answer to this, isn't it, Johan Cruyff?
Aiden, now, you've got two different types of forwards there. We've got the sort of, I don't know, the fox in the box, as it were, with Müller, and they've got the elegance of Cruyff. Now, your guy, bear in mind, you, I say earlier that you will pick the three same forwards. Dave and Aiden, Dave and Steve, nobody knows what's coming there, so deliver your guy, mate.
Everybody will know what's coming because this is simply the greatest European Cup forward of them all. Another of the greatest Real Madrid side of the 50s and early 60s is, of course, Alfredo Di Stefano. One of the greatest players the world has ever known, but I don't think he gets fully recognised as such. So here's our chance to put that right. He was better known for Real Madrid, than for his international achievements, which is, I guess, where he falls short of his contemporaries in some people's minds, gets a bit more forgotten. But if we're talking European Cup here, there is simply no greater forward in the tournament's history, even if you do include the Champions League years. He was instrumental in Real's dominance in Spain and Europe in the 50s and 60s, like I say, one of only three players to play a part in all five of those consecutive European Cup victories, along with the aforementioned Paco Gento, of course, who went a little further, and Jose Maria Zaraga. But Di Stefano was the only player to have scored in all five of those finals, including a hat-trick in the last of those, that remarkable Hampden victory that we mentioned earlier, the finest exhibition of club football I've ever seen. He scored 49 goals in 58 matches for Real in the European Cup. That was easily a record at the time, of course, but one that has since been surpassed by a handful of players in the modern age. Of many more matches, including Raul, Cristiano Ronaldo and Karim Benzema from his own club, Real. But he is still ninth in the overall European Cup / Champions League top scorers list. And if you look at that list, his goals per game ratio is hugely better than all of those above him on the list. For instance, his 49 goals in 58 games Like I say, puts him ninth. Above him in eighth is Thierry Henry with 50 goals, but it took him 112 games to do that. The ratio is just simply utterly different, and that's before I even go on to the likes of Ronaldo and Messi. In the top lists only, Gerd Müller and Puskás usurp him for goals per game in the European Cup era, and only Erling Haaland from the Champions League era, who's breaking the records as we speak. He is still clearly that great. And to be ninth overall, having scored so many with so few games, is truly astonishing. He is simply one of the world's absolute greats. But more than that, he's an absolute great of the European Cup, the arena in which his finest glories were played out, in the gleaming white of Real Madrid, a kit fit for footballing forward royalty, one of the very greatest forwards ever seen, whose realm was the European Cup.
Nice one. Okay, as I said, there were three. These guys were the three you each chose in slightly different orders. So obviously, it was going to be a close one. So, Dave, if we leave the poacher supreme, Der Bomber, to one side, you've got Cruyff and you've got Di Stefano. What are you thinking? Would you check? I mean, if you want to pick one of those guys to play with the baggy centre forward, Marty, would you pick?
I'll pick Di Stefano now. I don't know how you pick between the two of them, to be honest, because they are the two of the European Cup period, even more so than Gerd Müller. I mean, Cruyff, as Stephen says, he is the pictures that you see of the European Cup, you know, that Ajax team. And Cruyff was so central to it. But, I mean, that Real Madrid side that defined the European Cup in those early years, as Aidan pointed out, I mean, they're not best served because obviously there wasn't a television from that period. But De Stefano's goal-scoring record is absolutely immense through that period. He scores in how many finals? Five or six finals? It's just insane. I don't know. I wouldn't like to be you, Gary. That's all I can say.
That's funny. Stevie, okay, so if we leave Cruyff to one side then, Müller or Di Stefano?
So much time for Gerd Müller. But I always associate Gerd Müller, you know, away from certainly the 74 European Cup final replay, but the World Cup more than anything else. The amount of goals that he just, you know, swept in 1970 is, you know, his contribution and winning gold to the 1974 final. That's my reset image of Gerd Müller. No matter, and that's amazing considering just what he did in the Bayern Munich shirt. You know, metronomic. You know, the name Gerd is just synonymous with goals. And it was Robbie Fowler's training pitch nickname amongst his teammates. They call him Gerd, and you know, in honour of the great man. Can't speak highly enough of him. You know, absolutely phenomenal footballer. But you know, Di Stefano is Di Stefano, isn't he? You know, there's certain players that, you know, just you know, command respect, you know, eternal respect, you know, legends. You know, there needs to be a word that's kind of beyond legendary, really. You know, there's certain players who hit a, you know, a legendary, and then others who go even further. They'll just stratospheric, you know, levels. And Di Stefano is one of those. You can't get away from that. You know, he was the European Cup in those formative years.
Aidan, okay, so perhaps you can give me a little bit of help here then. I mean, obviously you have the Cruyff era with Ajax, which was supplanted by the Müller era with Bayern. Both of them won three successive European Cup titles. Throw me a bone here, buddy. Give me help.
I'm not sure that I can, Gary. These two were my other two picks, so the same for the other guys. I think both, if I picture them, I see them in their international kit first and their club kit after that, whereas Di Stefano I see only in his club kit. Now, I know I'm not meant to go on about Di Stefano, but to my mind, if I had to pick one of the others, I would possibly go just marginally Cruyff. For some of the reasons Stephen was setting out, because Gerd Müller's World Cup goes beyond anything Cruyff did World Cup-wise in terms of forward play, scoring, winning, and all of that. So I would possibly do that in terms of European Cups. But really, if you're asking me to pick somebody not Di Stefano, I wouldn't.
Okay. When I think about these, I try to put one to one side and then sort of, you know, pick between the two. And I think if I look in, it's Muller and Cruyff because they're the similar sort of era. I think Cruyff's the more complete footballer. Muller's the sort of the guy who scores with, goes up his knee, doesn't care, couldn't care less. So I think I'd go with Cruyff ahead of Muller. Di Stefano, we've had Paco and we've had Ferenc Puskas already. And it seems harsh if I don't go with Di Stefano, not only because of his wonderful talent, but also because of the Real Madrid team that was so dominant so early in the competition. But I think that was also because they had such a great team as well, and the rest of the European club was catching up with them. So I'm going to go with Cruyff, because I think Cruyff is emblematic of the European Cup. You know, and as Stevie quite rightly said, it was the TV era with colour television. And yeah, I've got to go with Cruyff. Anything else would be wrong.
Sacrilege.
I think there's some personal bias going on here, Gary. Definitely some personal bias.
I'm sorry, but the judge is going to say, order, order. Don't make me clear the court. I mean, look, with these things, I always try to put personal opinion to one side. And I just think with, you know, as I say, if you say who is emblematic of the European Cup, Di Stefano or Cruyff, most people would probably go for Cruyff, not least because of the era Di Stefano was perhaps not as successful, perhaps it wasn't as publicised as Cruyff's. But I think Cruyff was emblematic in his says he was a sort of a guy leading a younger team rather than the established powerhouse that Real Madrid was. But anyway, there you go. It's so close. It's harsh on Real Madrid not getting a single blooming choice. That's a terrible thing to say, but there you are. So we're going to move on to coaches now, just to close us out. And I'm going to start with you, Aidan, on this one. Coach, you're going to tell me who your choice is, and you can start now.
Yes, I've gone for Arrigo Sacchi. He twice led AC Milan, but his first stint from 87 to 91 was what we're really focused on here, and it was exceptional by anyone's standards. He won the Serie A title in his debut season in 1988, before then dominating European football for the next two seasons, winning European Cup in 89 and 1990. Beyond those statistics, though, I guess it's the way in which he achieved those victories, reinventing Italian and European football as he did so, that was so enticing, so appealing. He's regarded as one of the greatest managers of all time, a controversial character as well. But with the Milan of that time, that's the Milan of Hullit, Van Basten, Rijkaard, Baresi, Maldini, Donadoni and more, becoming one of the greatest club sides to have ever played the game under his direction. Unusually, of course, for someone to have achieved such feats, he was never a professional footballer, working as a shoe salesman, famously. But on reaching the giddy heights of the Milan coach's job, this led to a bit of a questioning of his credentials by the press, which led to his famous quote, that I never realised that in order to become a jockey, you first have to have been a horse, which I quite like. He had been inspired by the fluid styles of several of the teams we've mentioned, or characters we've mentioned, Honved, Real Madrid, Brazil 70, Netherlands 74. Milan beat Steaua Bucharest in the 1989 final, 4-0 in an astonishing display of excellence. Hullit and Van Basten each scoring twice, having already thumped Real Madrid 6-1 in the semi-finals. This was Milan's greatest moment, with the 1990 final being a little less spectacular, but overcoming Bayern in the semis on away goal before beating Benfica 1-0. That's the cursed Benfica, as it still was at the time. Rijkaard getting the only goal. Sacchi's Milan therefore became the first team to retain the European Cup since Nottingham Forest in 80, and the last team to do that until Madrid would do it almost three decades later. His approach, which is what really stands him out, he was unusual at the time and even more so for Italian football. Focus on strong defensive play in Italy was a bit of an anathema to him. His was a fluid but highly organised attacking formation, 4-4-2, discarding the libero. But he was an advocate of the team over the individual. He was an idealist. The spirit guides the hands, as both he and Michelangelo said. And for Sacchi, this was in a far more regimented, autocratic way than some of those he was inspired by, but his was a style of sophisticated patterns and apparent fluidity based on strictly defined plans worked on to excess in the sort of shadow play style that he used to practice. But his vision crafted one of the greatest sides Europe and indeed the world has ever seen.
Good one, Mighty. 2 minutes, 59.17 seconds, Aiden.
Oh, I'm improving.
That's pretty impressive. Dave, I'm going to come on to your guy now, and I'd be surprised if this guy was inspired by the words of Michelangelo. But you know, you never know, so tell me your pitches, Dave.
We're going to go with Luka Petrovic, who won the 1991 European Cup with Red Star Belgrade. He only came into the job at the beginning of that season after they'd already qualified for the competition. And what he took was an already impressive Red Star team and then just turbocharged it. They were technically gifted, well drilled, all of that sort of stuff. But I think Petrovic brought in heavy metal football before Jurgen Klopp even got there. I mean, they were just an irresistible force. They pressed. The pace that they played, that was amazing. The technical ability was obvious all over the pitch. Great players. They came through against Grasshopper Zurich. They beat Rangers. They came through a riot in Dresden against Dynamo. And then they got to the semi-final and they beat Bayern Munich, which, you know, is the test, really, I suppose, in many ways of the credentials of any European Cup side. And they did it by scoring loads and loads of goals, by being attack-minded, by playing some wonderful football. And they then get to the European Cup final and they play Marseille. And it's a very different Red Star Belgrade that plays that game. And I think this, you know, one of the things that draws me to this is it is the great existential question of football. What's better? Is it better to be loved or is it better to have a big pot on your mantelpiece? And I think when they got to that final, Petrovic's choice was, right, we're going to have the pot. Doesn't matter what we have to do, we're going to have the pot. So having played all this great attacking football all the way through and being fluid and you know, fast, high-pressing, all that sort of stuff, when they came to play Marseille, you know, the Marseille of Waddle and Papin and Abidi Pelé and Basil Boli and all of that kind of stuff, he decided that they weren't going to win by going toe-to-toe with them. And so he crafted a completely different Red Star team that would defend, would go all the way through to penalties and would win the cup that way. And I suppose, you know, in that sense, it made for a pretty terrible final. But from a coach's perspective, he got there by playing one kind of football and then had the ability to make his team change and play a completely different kind of football to win the final and to carry it off. And when you think of what was going on in Yugoslavia at the time, and Croatia was about to have independence and all that kind of stuff. It was a one-shot deal for Red Star Belgrade. The pressure was massive. They had to win that cup final or they would never win the European Cup. He changed his tactics, he changed his philosophy, and he got the cup. That, I think, is the mark of a great coach.
You know, it's interesting, Dave. You know, you're doing it again, really. You've just done it again here. When I saw Petrovic come up, I thought, oh, you know, okay. I remember the final with Red Star and Marseille. There have been some fantastic games on the way to. I was really looking forward to the final. You know, it could be really entertaining, you know, two attacking teams going at it head-to-head. And it was just a damn squib. But you quite rightly spotted that, you know, great coach can find more than one way to win a game. And as you say, at the end of the day, what do you want a pot on the table? Or do you want to be lauded as a good loser? So, yeah, typical Dave Bowler, great pitch, buddy. Thank you very much for that. Stevie, I'm thinking you're already back towards Anfield, mate. So away you go.
I am indeed going full circle. I don't care who parted on it seems. But he speaks for himself. He is the European Cup's most successful manager. The only man to win three European Cups within the European Cup here. Forget the Champions League, different thing altogether. He wins three European Cups, 1977, 1978 and 1981. Tactical mastermind, empire builder, ball, you know, the introduction of the ball playing central defenders, you know, everything that he does steps up notch by notch to get to this span between 77 and 81. You know, it's everything that surrounds it. You know, it's the opposition. It's the calibre of the opposition. It's the calibre of the coaches he goes up against. It's truly incredible. know, from Saint-Étienne, you know, 77, Benfica, 78, BMG, both 77 and 78, Bruges in 78, Aberdeen and Ferguson, CSKA, as mentioned earlier on, that Bayern Munich in 81 that had printed out leaflets for the Bayern supporters on how to get to Paris. They were so sure they were going to be getting to the 1981 European Cup final after goal was scored at Anfield in the first leg. Just the way he could outwit, and in his own terminology, he would throw oppositions a bit of toffee. That was how he would describe it. Underplayed everything that he ever did. Rounded it out with victory against Real Madrid in the 81 final. But it's kind of the 77 final, Borussia Mönchengladbach, magnificent side, led by Udo Lattek, a man who'd won the European Cup for Bayern Munich in 1974. 78, he was up against Ernst Happel. He'd won the European Cup in 1970. And then it's Vujadon Boskov in 81. These are, some of the greatest thinkers of football history. And two out of those three have already won the European Cup when he goes up against them in European Cup finals. It's 77 to 78. It's the way he essentially turns Emlyn Hughes into Alan Hansen. It's Ian Callaghan becomes Graham Souness and Kevin Keegan becomes Kenny Dalglish. There are four changes between the 77 and the 78 winning sides. And the difference between when they walk out and win the European Cup in 84, a year after Paisley leaves, the 11 players that take the pitch in Rome are all still Paisley-sourced players. It's, not down playing what Joe Fagan does. That's a different podcast. But it has to be Bob Paisley. There's no other sensible answer.
Aidan, now then, do I need a bit of help from you if you can? Were you persuaded by Davis Petrovic pitch or Paisley's longevity and, Stevie says, the most successful manager in the history of the European Cup? Tell me.
Well, Petrovic pitch was very, very good, of course, as you'd expect. But no, I wasn't persuaded by it versus Bob Paisley. Yeah, I think as Steve ended his pitch with, there's no other obvious answer than Bob Paisley, and that's all I can say here. He was, in fact, the number one pick I would have gone for as well, but I put that in knowing full well that somebody else would probably get to do that one. So, yeah, I would certainly go for Bob Paisley.
Dave, Sarke, Paisley, is he close?
I'm kind of regretting I didn't go for Brian Clough now. it is closer than you'd think. I mean, that Milan side was such a fantastic team to watch. And, they did change football in a way at that period. And certainly what you expected from Italian football. That wasn't what you expected when you turned up to watch Milan or any Italian side at that point. I mean, Bob Paisley is just obviously a fantastic manager. Did amazing things with that Liverpool team. But, of course, it's Bill Shankly's team, isn't it, really, Stephen? Let's be honest.
No, it's not. Oh,
it's Bill Shankly's football club. Everything that comes after it is Bill Shankly. It all belongs
to him. It's Bill Shankly's foundations, and it's Bob Paisley's veranda. No, that's what he's done.
Yeah, you can't have a veranda without the outs, can you? So that's the difficulty. But no, yeah, Bob Paisley.
Okay, Stevie. I know you could put your red glasses off for a bit, buddy, and tell me, were you convinced by Davis Petrovic's pitch? What about Sarke?
Petrovic is a great character, absolutely wonderful, and what he did with Red Star is incredible. At a point in time when it's all, it's all kicking off around him in no uncertain terms, and for what's to come in the years to follow. Absolutely amazing what was achieved there. But you can't get away from the pragmatism of that final. You really can't. You really, really can't. I mean, it says everything, really. The Saint-Étienne of 1976 is held in so much more awe for what they did in rattling the woodwork multiple times, and a game they dominate against Bayern and couldn't get over the line because they just couldn't get the ball past the square goalpost in Glasgow and all that type of stuff compared to that Red Star side. And it's just the way that that final, given what they did against Bayern in the semi, it feels like a betrayal of beauty, in that respect. Sarke, put together an amazing side at Milan. And you've got to, with Sarri, what you've got to realise as well is, you know, just how, you know, uniformly middle of the road they were up until the summer of 86. And what he took them to do in such a short space of time, in such a, you know, a ludicrously strong Serie A. But the thing is as well, for each three of the managers that we've brought to the table here as well, these have all had to win their domestic league to get into this competition. You know, it's not like it is now where, you know, you are automatically in there because you finish in the top four. And it's a virtual guarantee for the vast majority of big clubs in the biggest leagues. You know, this is a totally different landscape, and you know, with total massive respect for Rigo Sarri, you know, and what he did in piecing that side together. And you know, but again, you know, it's wild to think that under the flag of the Champions League, but still a competition that you had to win your title to get into. It's what Capello does in 94 that kind of overshadows what Sarri did. But yeah, I'd have to go with Sarri out of the two, but it's mad to think that Sarri kind of is overshadowed by his protege because of that dismantling of Barcelona in 94. But yeah, Petrovic, fantastic character. We've got to remind everything he's done there, but an anti-hero, you know, in many respects. And if you can be, you know, you can have a comparison between two managers, and one of them is kind of stereotypical Italian coach, brought up in a chessboard era of how to create a football team, and you're looking at him as the more expansive of the two. It says everything about that final in 91.
This is really interesting. I mean, I think, you know, first thing I'd say that is Petrovic is typical diabolic pitch, brilliant. But I think it's overshadowed, as Petrovic is probably overshadowed by the two other guys. And it's interesting with looking at, you know, what you two guys have said about Paisley and Sarri. They're almost like, Sarri's almost Paisley. So he's almost, sorry, Shankly, as much as he set the one in place and Capello followed, as Shankly did with Liverpool, and Paisley followed. Both built their own team afterwards. And I mean, the big thing with Sarri as well is he changed the dynamic of Italian football massively. You know, forget this Catenaccio, I'm going to play attacking football and set up the players to do it. That said, it would be, I think it'd be almost criminal not to say Paisley is probably the standout coach of the European Cup and probably deserves his place on Red Bull. But I'm going to go with Bob Paisley to give him that. I think that's fair enough. I call Paisley on that one. So, guys, that concludes the Mount Rushmore debate from the European Cup. So our selections are Clements, Beckenbauer, Bobby Charlton, Cruyff and Paisley, with a nod to Real Madrid. Sorry, guys, we're not getting a single player out there because that's probably a bit of a sin. But there we go. So, listeners, it's over to you now. We'd love to hear some feedback from you. Did the guys make the good choices? I should have included Hans Doy, I know that, but you know, let's move on. And were there convincing pitches for their selections? Who did we miss out? Who should have been considered? Of course, did the judge make the right decisions? Of course I did. Seriously, that'd be great to hear your thoughts on Twitter. Just tag these footy times and hashtag TFTMRD. That's at these footy times, hashtag TFTMRD. And let us know what you're thinking. Dave, have you had a good time, buddy?
No, it's been really enjoyable. It's been good fun. I'm just waiting for the day when Stephen picks Ray Clements up front.
he did play up front in five-a-side training. Precisely. So when we're doing the five-a-side training episode, then Clements is coming into the strikers category there.
It's funny you mentioned that. Yeah, Stevie, good time, mate. You got Ray Clements out of the line. Well done, buddy.
I did. I got a hat-trick out of that one. I'm quite impressed. I can rest easy tonight now. But yeah, when Dave said, I wish I'd have picked Brian Clough, I was sweating. And when he said Petrovic, I thought, it's nailed in now. I'm on air.
I tell you what, I was talking to the wife before I came on air, and she asked her what we're doing. She said, who's picked Clough? I said, actually, nobody. Well, I do think it was somebody's third choice. Yeah, I think it was Aiden's third choice. But yeah, Clough would have been a great argument. You know, I thought Dave might have gone with that one because that would have been, I think he nailed that one. Aiden, had a good time, matey?
I have, yes, absolutely. It's always fun, but I think I'll round off the evening by going and watching an endless loop of Di Stefano's European Cup goals to soothe my pain.
Yeah, apologies to the great man himself, and I say it to Real Madrid, if I were even Spain anywhere, for not to get all those trophies and not to get a single player in the Mount Rushmore is probably harsh, but they've probably got their own Mount Rushmore anyway, so they probably don't care. So I just say thanks to listeners for listening to us and the debate, and catch us again next time on the Lob Podcast from These Football Times. Cheers and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.